Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is James Stiegel. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Molly Martin and Darylyn Evans. Today, we're talking with science fiction author Michael Cooper. Born in Saskatchewan, Canada, Michael Cooper has been writing stories since he first finished Return of the King and did not want the tale to end. Michael likes to describe the town he grew up in as being the one featured in American Graffiti, only transferred the 90s. When he wasn't racing stock cars, swapping engines, rebuilding a carb, or porting the heads on an engine, he was surrounded by computers, alternately writing books and software. Michael has operated an ISP, written software that powered whitehouse.gov, built many hundreds of websites, constructed dozens of tables from reclaimed wood, and smashed out over 30 published novels worth of words on his keyboard. On January 1st of 2017, Michael made the leap to full-time author and has been hard at work ever since, crafting the Aeon 14 universe, which now has dozens of novels written by over six authors telling tales that span 6,000 years. Michael likes to call himself a jack of all trades, but if you get a few beers into him, he'll tell you that he's a future historian. Michael Cooper, welcome to Sentence to Paragraph.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thank you for being here. So our focus this year is on world building, and you have one of the most ambitious world building projects of any author that I've met. In a recent Facebook post, you talked about your plans to take Aeon 14 out another 50,000 years to what may result in 500 novels. Is that true?
That 500 is my lowball.
You're nodding.
Yeah, so 500 is the number I share with other people. The real number is actually over 600 that I plan for, but I give myself a little bit of room for failure in there.
What do they call that? The big, hairy, audacious goal?
Yes, exactly.
It's inspiring. Yeah, exactly. So before we get started, we like to ask authors to read from some of their recent work. Were you able to bring something in to read today?
I did, yep. I brought an excerpt from my book, Rika Outcast.
Rika Outcast. Awesome. So how would you set this up?
So Rika is a mechanized human. And this gets into sort of a common sci-fi idea where the big giant mechs that you see fighting, like Pacific Rim and stuff like that, really aren't a great idea. They're just giant targets, effectively. If you look at modern warfare, something like the M1 Abrams tank is actually a very low-profile vehicle. It doesn't stick up that much, is really what it comes down to. And it can move fast, it can shoot accurately. So the way that science, the way that a lot of people think about the military in the future are thinking is they're thinking what are called mechanized humans. And then right now it's about stuff with exoskeletons, you know, and you see the military starting to do stuff like that where they're wearing these exoskeletons. They can lift more and run faster and so on and so forth. None of that's really hit production yet, at least that we know of. But you see those tropes in science fiction movies a lot where people are cyborgs. They've got some cybernetic limbs and so on and so forth. And I thought to myself, as I was watching a particular show, I thought, what would that really be like for these people? Because not a lot of people are really going to get signed up to get their limbs chopped off. So I thought I wanted to create a story about a woman who, against her will, was turned into a mechanized warrior by her nation. And then her nation lost the war. And now she's basically living on a station trying to make ends meet with this body that's not really even hers anymore. And so the story has a lot of stuff that deals with what amputees deal with, what people with body dysphoria issues deal with, about a woman who doesn't see herself as a woman anymore because everything that she thought made her a woman has been taken away, and how she deals with all of those issues. And so that's where the story picks up, or what I'm about to read picks up at that point. So do you want me to go ahead and just give you guys a little reading?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Rika walked slowly through the warrens of Deck 741. 100 levels down from Hal's Hell, and just 3 away from her quarters. The wide corridor was crowded with other workers heading home or up to the docks to begin their shifts. Refugees, long since turned to beggars, huddled along the bulkheads, the poor and unfortunate who had fled the fall of the Parsons system, only to make it to Dakar and no further. She felt pity for them, but not so much that she could afford to share any of her spare credits, were she to have such a thing. The war had taken everything from her, too. These beggars may think that they lived a hellish afterlife, but Rika knew that even their blighted existence was far more desirable than hers. An indicator flashed on her visual overlay, reminding Rika that her internal batteries were down to 10%. Back when they were new, the batteries could hold a charge for longer, under more strain. But now they were showing their age. Just a few hours of overtime, and she was running on her last jewels. Maybe better if I didn't antagonize Hal so much, Rika thought, shaking her head with a rueful smile on her lips. A dozen meters down the corridor stood her favorite food stall. Well, her favorite stall that served any food she could afford. Jesse, the owner, would also let her plug in for a quick charge while she ate. As Rika approached the stall, she saw a few members of Pinky's gang further down the wide passageway, alternately mocking and extorting the refugees and passersby. Rika did her best to ignore them, hoping they wouldn't spot her. No small number of local gang leaders were constantly pressuring her to join their ranks. They promise parts and power, but little respect. Long shift, Jesse commented as Rika approached and leaned an elbow on the counter. Rika smiled at the pink-haired proprietor. The fact that Jesse never mentioned Rika's mechanized body and always looked in their eyes, her in the eyes, even before her surgery, was the other reason why Rika frequented her stand. You too, Jesse, Rika replied. You were here when I left for my shift this morning. Jesse shrugged. Yeah, Annie ditched me again today, said she has some sort of ache or pain. I kind of don't mind, though. She's a shit worker, and if I don't have to pay her ass, it's a win for me. Yeah, and she can't flip a burger for the life of her, Rika replied. And now that I can eat burgers again, I hate having to settle for what she can produce. Never fear, Rika. Your favorite mystery meat delight is coming right up. Maybe someday both you and I can get off this shit station. I'll cook you up a real burger. I'd like that very much, Rika said as she spooled out her charge cable and handed it to Jesse, who plugged it in behind the stand's counter. Rika felt a sense of relief as her charge meter showed the power trickling back in. Running out of power in the Warrens was one of her worst fears. She harbored no illusions about what would become of her if that happened down here. With power, she was one of the most formidable people on the station. Without it, she was scrap metal waiting to be picked clean. There you have it.
Wow.
That was great.
Thanks.
So, you know, Michael, for me, Rika is a great example of world building through character. And I'm wondering if you could talk about what drew you to Rika. Was it something specific that you wanted to say about the future in Aeon 14? Or was it really just that initial spark from thinking of that character and did it grow from there?
I think there were two main drivers. One, so the show I was watching that kind of got me thinking along these lines was, it's called Killjoys. It's on Sci-Fi. And there's a character that was in it at the end of the second season who was she had her arm replaced with a gun, and she was made at a place called the Factory, and there were a lot of people that were basically mechanized there and sold for various purposes. It was sort of like a half slavery, half technology sort of storyline. And I thought to myself that they for the first time they really gave a lot of attention to what this character was going through to be this. Usually the cyborg character in a science fiction show is just sort of like the meaty muscle that you don't really get to know that much, and it was different to have a woman be this character. And to have her, you know, see her sort of dealing with the identity crisis that it created for her. And so I got the idea of, like, you know, what would it be like to investigate this idea in Aeon 14? And in a lot of the stories in Aeon 14, Aeon 14 sort of spans a long period of human history where there's a lot of ups and downs. And the main character throughout most of the stories, her name is Tanis, and she comes from the golden age of humanity. Her body is eventually it's 0% original organic equipment anymore. But even at most, at her best, it's only like maybe 40 or 50% organic. But she looks perfectly normal. You wouldn't be able to tell that she was made like this. She's capable of, like, at one point she just has her muscles removed from her legs so they could actually use a particular disguise. And that's not a big deal for them to do that sort of thing with the level of technology they have. But I thought, like, what about a place where they don't have big high levels of technology? What would it be like for someone who had this work done to them and then could barely stay alive after as a result? So it allowed me to show a very different side of future civilizations where, you know, the people that don't have access to a lot of resources can be in a very bad place after some of these technological advances are used on them. And not to say sort of like that technology is a bad thing, but just to say that there's another side to it and be able to present that to the readers.
What's the saying, that the future is not evenly distributed?
Yeah, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed.
Right, William Gibson. Yeah. Well, you know, actually, I should have backed up, I think, because let's, from a world-building perspective, and I think I forgot to say that during this year, we're focused on world-building. You've created an incredibly ambitious world. And can you talk about what led you to even want to develop Aeon 14? And then as you thought about the span of it, how did you kind of conceptualize that and then start, you know, coloring in the details, basically, or at least the waypoints that you were going to try and touch?
Sure. Well, like all good modern science fiction stories, I was inspired by Joss Whedon's Firefly. it got into my head just sort of thinking about, because it was such a different vision of the future. It was a starship that had cattle on it sometimes and stuff like that. But as I thought, I've done a lot of research into where technology is going and how things are advancing. And I felt like we're gonna advance beyond the stage where we need to haul cattle on starships before that opportunity would ever come up, because we're gonna be, you know, by the time we can fly between different star systems, we'll just carry a bunch of embryos, and then we'll raise them in 6 weeks or something like that, and have full-grown cattle in 6 weeks on a different planet, you know, 100 light years away. So there would never be a scenario where you would haul cattle. But I thought, what if I could construct a future human history where these different things would happen due to the rise and fall of civilizations and whatnot, where technology comes along and it disrupts and then certain things happened that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And so I realized to do that, I needed to create this really long time frame, pull it all off, because I wanted to actually have civilization rise to these amazing heights and then smash it all, and then write about people living in the ruins of the civilization. And then as they come out of these ruins and different things happen, that basically create a lot of great stories. And that's sort of how it was all came about. The other thing that was a really big determining factor for me is I thought, you know, you see a lot of science fiction where people talk about you got fast and light travel, and you got teleportation, and you've got all these different fancy weapons and whatnot. But they always focus on one thing. You know, what if we had AI? And what if we had Jedi who have lightsabers, you know? And what if we had faster than light travel? And I said, what if they all happen? What if every single science fiction thing you've ever imagined all occur? Maybe not at the same time, but what would that ultimately do? And that's sort of what created the foundation for everything I started to do.
So the idea of everything happening all at once, is that for you as a world-building technique, is that coming from just that basically all technology is possible, you know, eventually if we can dream it, it's going to happen?
Basically, yeah. And a lot of it also came from my research. As I was researching more and more advances, I realized that every one of these advances, like, you know, NASA is actually investigating, could they make a warp drive that could actually fold space and cause ships to travel very quickly? Obviously, they're, you know, it's very high-level investigation right now. And there's other people investigating teleportation. There's other people investigating, and they've actually teleported particles already. That sort of thing has happened. There's stuff like the technological singularity, where it's predicted that in about 30 or 40 years, a computer processor with the same processing power as one human race, so 6 billion humans have as much processing power as one chip, and that chip will cost 5 cents to manufacture. So you think about, like, what is that going to do to civilization? How will that change everything? Some people say we won't ever get there. I think that people think right now technology goes like this, but it doesn't. There's some of this that happens in technology too. It's called the complexity break. And so I thought about a lot of that, and I worked out a timeline that basically goes from now until the year 9000. And I sort of just slide everybody, all these different events into that. And now I forget the question. Hopefully I answered it.
Well, I think Aeon 14 even has a meaning as well, right? Can you
it
touch
does.
On that?
'Cause that's, yep. So I have sort of this weird religious scientific view where I was brought up believing that the world was 10,000 years old. And then I learned about this thing called the cosmic microwave background radiation. And that is the thing that creates static on your television, for those of us who remember what static on television looked like before it was just a blue screen. And there's other things that do it as well, but it's actually measurable in the static on your television. And it's the echo of the Big Bang. And the reason why we know the universe is a particular age old is because the echo of the Big Bang is decreasing at a particular rate. Now, there's also other things like how far back we can see and stuff like that. But when I learned about that, I thought, well, that's a very difficult thing to say that, you know, isn't there. Like, it's the static on my television, and I can see that. And that is the echo of the Big Bang. And I say, if you're a religious person, you can consider that be the echo of creation. And they both work. And everybody can sort of just be happy with this whole idea that our universe has been around for a while. And whether or not a God created the world in 7 days, or a God sparked this one thing that unfolded over 14 billion years and became our current universe, both of those are equally impressive. I was able to sort of reconcile these two worldviews I had with that and come up with this idea that, okay, the universe can be 14 billion years old, which is actually why the series is called Aeon 14, because the universe is technically 13.8. is what they think is how old, 13.8 billion years old. So just like this is the 21st century, we are now in the 14th aeon of the universe. And aeon is a word in astronomy that means 1 billion years. So that's where it comes from.
Again, getting back to that big goal.
Yeah.
But so one of the things, you know, when we think about, so you have all these details banging around in your head, and obviously you got to choose. So when you think about the scope and when you have this huge world that you want to tray, and you filter that back to characters, you know, characters become the lens through which we see this world. How do you pick those details, and how do you go from having this huge amount of information and being able to transfer it to the reader in a way that makes sense? And before the show, we were talking about how you'd gone through some drafts where you had a lot of info dumping and you had a lot of just getting that information out. And then you got some feedback from Jill Cooper, your wife, who's also an author, about doing that through character. Can you talk a bit about how you've learned and how you've developed the skill of portraying world building through character? And
sure.
You know, what are some ways you approach that?
So a lot of us, what us writers do when we're creating a story is we, you know, we don't know everything when we start. We have an idea, you know, I have a certain character and they're in a place, something like this, and I need to get them from point A to point B, and they're going to have some sort of problem that occurs, something stopping them from doing that, or the whole reason is to get to point B because they have to stop something bad, you know, the different basic plot types. And as we're writing a book, we start to write down the setting. because we don't know what it is. So we're like, okay, they're walking down the street and look, oh, the houses are painted this color, or, you know, they're in a space station and things are done like this or things are done like that. And it's no different if it's a science fiction book or if you're writing about Stars Hollow for the Gilmore Girls. You know, you have all this setting that you're trying to relay to the reader. And there's two ways that you can do that. You know, you can have the character walking down the street just simply observing everything. And I did some of that in the snippet that you got as well, where I talked a little bit about just sort of the where Rika was and whatnot. And you have to do some of that. But then there's also, like, you know, instead of like talking about how there's no food or how like it's hard to get food, I have them have Jesse and Rika talking about those things. And so I do the same thing with a lot of the science as well. Instead of, you know, walking down the street in Stars Hollow and commenting on the color of the paint on the houses, you have a character shows up that starts bitching about it, you know, or something like that. I forget the guy's name. I don't know if you guys ever watched the Gilmore Girls, but they had this one guy who was fantastic because he complained about everything. And he was great because he could just show up and start complaining about things and it would like relay all of this information to the viewer about what's going on. And actually characters like that in books are great all around. Just have someone that bitches and moans all the time. And you'll be able to get a lot of information out to the reader. And so I did stuff like that with the characters. I had this great advantage in science fiction is that I have AIs. And my main character, Tanis, has an AI in her head named Angela. And Angela is very snarky. And Angela always has a comment about everything. So Tanis can be going around doing stuff. And I've got this monologue that's going on all the time where Angela is commenting on things or making fun of Tanis. And Tanis is responding and whatnot. And it lets me take all the stuff that's normally done as info dumps and create it and convert it into character conversations, which, of course, is fantastic because then the reader not only learns about the setting, they learn about what the character thinks of the setting, which is the thing that, you know, people relate to the most. People relate to people. Is what I always tell folks. That's sort of what I went through. And a lot of that, like James said, it came from my wife, who said when she read my first book, which is actually the fourth one that I published now, she said, your characters are cardboard cutouts that you're just moving around to facilitate the plot. So I can tell you have a certain plot you want to go through because you're just basically repositioning the characters into all these different places to say the things that they have to move the plot forward. And she didn't pull any punches when she said that to me. And then I thought to myself, I never want to write again. And I hate you. And then about 3 days later, I realized that she was right, and I got back to it, which is a perfectly normal process to go through whenever you get this sort of feedback.
Right.
I think every writer goes through that process when you get feedback. If you have to take your 2 days of, like, you get your feedback, and then you set your stuff aside and just be sad and angry and realize that anybody who has ever given you feedback other than your mom is 100% wrong. And then after 2 days, you can look at it and go, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Thank you for that feedback. I appreciate it. I appreciate your opinion. You did not have to give it to me. You know, one thing when we were talking about that occurred to me is I have learned so much from romance authors about how characters relate to each other, because that's the first thing they look at in a story is how two characters relate to each other, when I'm just thinking about the idea I'm trying to get across about some cool thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a huge learning point for me, and I've always appreciated their feedback.
Yeah, they have a very different view and this is something that I didn't realize I learned this when I was reading, because I used to read a lot. I don't read as much anymore because I'm too busy writing, but there was, like, my grade 12 year in high school, I read 400 books. I would skip class and go to the library, and for whatever reason, the librarians didn't seem to be bothered by the fact that this kid, like, would sit for the entire morning in their library, which no one should ever do in high school because they're, like, the class you're supposed to be going to. But I read so many books. And what I picked up from that I've realized since that not everybody gets is that the most important thing in a conversation is not the words, it's what the main character or the point of view character thinks about those words after they've been said. And so that's when you read a book and you just see this conversation, and lots of the responses do convey what they think. But there's a lot of other things that people don't say in conversations, things they think to themselves, and then they say something different. And that's the best stuff to really build out. And you're right, romance authors do a lot of that because that for them is the story.
Yeah, those interactions.
So it's more of a way of getting showing that internal conflict as well as just the external conflict, like you were talking about, where you just kind of are positioning the characters in the world, and that's the external conflict of, you know, they need to go to this star system and they need to do this and that. Mm-hmm. The internal conflict is, how do they feel about the fact that they have to go to the star system and leave their girlfriend, boyfriend, kids, whoever, yep, behind?
Or go with that guy they hate, you know, or something like that, you know, whatever. Yeah, they're all in the Millennium Falcon, you know, and with Chewie there, and they're like, how do we get this guy not to rip our arms off? You know, that's the fun part of the story.
Chewie guy is sketchy.
Yeah, he totally is.
You know, one thing we were talking about earlier, too, as part of this conversation, is just how different readers take different things from the story. And I think combining characters and world building really gets to that. And it's always interesting to hear feedback from some people that read a book and you think they'll be focused on the characters and they're not. It's some detail of your Starship's HVAC system that just completely throws them out of the narrative. And so when we talk about, you know, hard SF, especially if you're trying to basically create, you know, a fantastical world based on real science as we know it, what are some things that you do to try and make that clear to the reader, you know, to make that dream make sense for them so they don't get thrown out?
One of the things that's actually relatively, what am I trying to say here? Something that people don't seem to get a lot when they're writing science fiction is you actually have to be very in-specific. If you're too specific about certain things, you're going to get someone who has a specialty in that area that's going to lose their mind, like the HVAC scenario, which is a real scenario. It was an error in how we describe the HVAC system on a Starship, the air conditioning environmental systems. That just destroyed the book for this reader, and it went from a 5-star to a 3-star because of that in his mind. He knows who he is. He might even listen to this. but it's important. And so actually a big part of that is consulting with experts is one thing.
Right.
To make sure that you're not gonna melt the brains of anybody in a particular who works in a particular field. Another part of that is just not being too specific, where you just kind of say, like, they did a thing using the resources that you would expect them to have, because they do all these other things. And you try to be as vague as possible. I do work a lot, though, to be relatively specific on key things. You have to decide what's important and whatnot. Like, for example, the way the weapons work in AR-14 is really important because physics, a lot of what the series is about is about conflict. And so, of course, physics defines very specifically how weapons will actually work. And there's really no way of getting around it, you know. And that's actually something that is one of my biggest pet peeves of science fiction gets wrong the most, is that if you can see an enemy ship, you can shoot it. So most space combat would take place at distances of between 50, 100,000, 300,000 kilometers. You actually, the conflict would take place so far apart, you actually could not see the enemy ship. And so then this sort of gets into some of the fun stuff of what I find to be exciting about writing this type of science fiction. You're like, okay, basically what I've gotten to now is I'm writing a World War II sub story where you've got these guys in the submarine being really quiet, trying to listen for where the enemy is and trying to make these shots. Like the same sort of tension that you're writing, where you can't see where the enemy is and you have to like guess and make these special shots and your conflict may last a very short period of time in space. Because if you have two ships flying toward each other, they may actually only be at weapons range for 15 seconds or something like that. So you have to plan all that out. How would that work? How do you write that? How do you create the tension? And most science fiction authors, they sort of just take it easy and they pretend it's Napoleon fighting, what was the British admiral's name? Waterloo, the Battle of Waterloo. You know, there's got the galleons, they're all just lined up and they're just broadsiding each other. You know, that wouldn't happen in space. You know, like the opening scene on Star Trek, Revenge of the Sith, just makes you want to cry. Because like no starship would ever get that. Yeah, Star Wars. Yeah, no starship would ever get that close to their starship. It'd be insane. Just like that on the Navy, ships don't get that close to one another. So a lot of that all comes into it is you have to understand at least these basic premises of how these sorts of things would work. And then when you do understand it, instead of them being obstacles that make your writing harder, they become the obstacles the characters face. And that's all of your external conflict now. That you've got, and the setting is provide all this external conflict, and now your characters have to work around it. To be honest, that's half the story at that point.
No, that's a great point.
Happens. Yeah.
Everybody forgets about relative motion in space.
what I take away from all of this is that if you want to be a space marine, when they ask you if a spaceship leaves Earth traveling at 3,000 miles per hour, and another spaceship leaves Pluto traveling 4,000 miles per hour, you should pay attention to those questions.
Yes, exactly. Well, luckily,
what is your fuel consumption?
Lots of super nerdy people have actually produced online calculators for these things. So you can actually like put in the mass of a starship, your acceleration capabilities, and it will tell you how long it takes to get to Pluto. So a lot of these stuff has actually been solved for science fiction authors. There's super nerdy people out there. I've actually got a particle physicist who does some review of my books, and he's actually found errors in some of those calculators and has created his own as well, which is pretty nice.
Well, you know, one thing I just thought of, you think about a book like The Forever War, which is about, you know, soldiers operating in relativistic distances. And that's the entire conflict of that book. Like it's a Vietnam parable, but basically they go out to fight. And by dealing with that external conflict that you just brought up, it creates all the internal conflict for the soldiers when they come home dealing with an Earth that has changed by thousands of years, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting, you know, even from a world building perspective, you know, one of the things that I've got a friend right now who's writing a fantasy story in a world that has two moons. And so his magic system is based on the moons, but he's put an incredible amount of thought into the tidal systems of a planet with two moons, but it's made so much of his story, you know, so much richer, because obviously that's something all the characters really have to, that is the basis of their world, you know?
Yep. Yeah, there's some really fun stuff that it creates. It's basically like the languages in Lord of the Rings. You know, the languages and the history that you know is just sitting there under the surface all the time is what made the story so rich. That you always felt like, I'm not just sort of like, I'm not like wading in a wading pool here. I'm swimming in the deep end. And I know that there's just so much more depth supporting everything that I have going on. Like, for example, if you were to write a story where Venus has been terraformed and knocked off the clouds and they made Venus habitable, well, Venus's day is almost as long as its year. And it rotates backwards as well. So the sun will actually rise in the west and it will set in the east. And you're going to have about a six-month day on Venus. So that would change everything about the story. You know, people's behaviors would be different. You know, how sleep patterns would be different. It'd be basically like the folks who live in Alaska.
Right.
You know, what they have to do. So that sort of setting, when you can, so I love taking a world or an idea and making like this setting that is unnecessarily complicated in some respects, because you get to have so much fun with the characters at that point. And then that it drives so many interesting things in the story, because it's like, well, it wouldn't work like this. It would actually work like that because the setting demands it.
Well, one of the things I really liked about the way that you handled introducing character and setting issues is you helped focus the world building stuff through the lens of each character. So they kind of had their own things that they were interested in. And you know, characters who were in the military, they were really interested in guns and things that blow things up. Mm-hmm. And then you had other characters who were, you know, more interested in logistics or planetary movements or things like that, but they kind of all had their field. So you had a good filter to tell the reader, like, here's this thing about the world without just dumping everything at once. And I think that was a really good way to kind of measure out those little pieces of information so that it wasn't just everything.
Yeah, I did a lot of work, especially in the early novels where people are going to get used to everything, because the setting is very different from what people are used to. A lot of stuff only came up until it didn't come up until it was necessary. And a lot of things that would have been just common knowledge were almost never discussed. So the same sort of thing, like you don't learn about certain parts of planetary mechanics or why certain things are done a certain way until a character shows up that actually cares about it or it matters. The one downside to that is I do every now and then get accused of a lot of deus ex machina, because people are like, well, this thing just showed up. And I'm like, well, I could have told you about that 100 pages ago, but there'd be no reason to tell you about that 100 pages ago. You know, I can't leave Chekhov's guns everywhere. You'll just lose track of them after a while, you know? So that's the bit of the trade-off. But I think for the most part, I've done fairly well at it.
Well, and that might tie into my world building question, which will bridge to craft. Mm-hmm. So Daryl Lynn can start asking questions. how do you develop or maintain your consistency across, you know, your novels, and then now that you've got co-authors also working in the world? And I guess I should divulge that I also am working on a series within AN14. But with all these details and things to keep track of, what tools are you using to do that?
Nothing terribly sophisticated right now. I do need to rectify this problem. I have a Bible done in OneNote. I've got about, 150 documents, Word documents with various notes and stuff in them. And then I have a wiki that is about half done, but most of it I keep in my head, which annoys my co-authors. And I'm doing my best to get it all put out somewhere, but it's a lot of work. But a lot of it, I think the advantage to a lot of it is that it is all based on the laws of physics. So I at least have that to reference, that, you know, as long as we're not breaking the laws of physics and then of course the order of discoveries that have been established, then most things tend to work out. The one thing I have learned is we got to stay away from biological stuff. That stuff is complex. Trying to deal with like how viruses work and stuff like that. Like that's so far out of my wheelhouse. I'm just like, I don't want to do that anymore. That one's for Pope.
Didn't you just deal with that in a recent book?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. It was hard too. Because a lot of AN14 takes place in post-scarcity societies where there's no more disease. So I've got to figure out the scenarios where they can actually have a disease and what it would do and how it would work and stuff like that, which is far more complex than I'm qualified to figure out. Luckily, I have a lot of readers who have a lot of expertise, so that helps out.
So turning to craft, I'm really curious, because thinking about how you're crafting your own stories, but also crafting this world and trying to help all of your other authors, I guess, tell their stories well, where does craft happen in there compared to, I guess, is there the world building piece and cataloging and building your Bible, as you said, for all of here are the world pieces, and then what, and then creating characters and whatnot. I guess where does craft happen in there for you, and what do you think of that as your craft?
What I tell all of the co-authors, at least I hope I've told them all, is that the thing I want them to do most is write a story that they're excited about. So long as it doesn't have any major technological issues, those can all be fixed later on. If I come across something like, that actually wouldn't work that way, it would work like this, it would be fine. Recently I said, so long as your character motivations are consistent, everything else can be worked around. The thing that is hardest to fix is if you have a character who's waffling between different reasons why they're doing things, that you can't fix later on, because that could completely redo the plot for the story. But if it's just stuff like, does weapon A fire further than weapon B, or does the communication system, can it do this thing? That's stuff that's easy to fix. So I do tell them to focus on the story, focus on the characters, make them interesting, give them something that's challenging to do. And from a craft perspective, the other advice I have that ties in all this is, I say, most people, and this isn't true of everybody, but most people like to read the A-Team. They want to read about a core group of people who are friends, who have an unshakable bond, and for whom most of their conflict is external. And another great example of this is My Little Pony. My Little Pony is the best kid show ever because all of the conflict's external. I mean, there is some internal conflict, but whenever there is internal conflict, the characters grow from that and they don't make the same mistakes again. Unlike Strawberry Shortcake, where the characters make the same mistakes over and over again, and it's really frustrating. Yes, I have a young daughter. But I learned a lot about that, because I thought, like, as I was watching My Little Pony, I'm like, these guys are really good at making sure that the conflict is external. Because, and the whole thought, I mean, obviously the premise of My Little Pony is friendship is magic. So it's all about this core group of friends becoming closer friends. And I thought a lot too about, like, the things, like, you know, you read books like The Band of Brothers and whatnot, and you read military books about how these bonds are formed between people when they go through crises, and those bonds are very strong. And a lot of books, when you read them, you'll end up with these characters that have gone through these very bonding experiences that don't do that. And that feels very unrealistic to me, you know, based on what I've seen in the real world about how people that work together and struggle together form bonds that are very hard to break. And they're also much more immune to smaller issues. And you see that, like, for example, in marriages that are long running, very successful marriages where they, the biggest thing that they do well to keep things going is they're really good at not worrying about the small stuff. And so, that's one of the pieces of advice I give to authors, is when you want to write a book that people read for entertainment. And there's a very different scenario between people who are trying to write a literary book that may be about a particular piece of subject matter or something like that, where they can't do that because of the story they're telling. But if you want to write a story that's very entertaining, people will be more entertained by external conflict than they will be by internal conflict. Now, that does skew by gender a bit. Women do enjoy internal conflict more than men do. So you have to actually have that too, obviously, to hold both your audiences. But yeah, that's actually one of the big pieces of advice is it is about keeping your conflict external, making so the characters are having fun, and then the readers will have fun too.
I find that interesting advice because I think what we're really attached to reading for is that character's internal struggle with what's happening in the external world. And so keeping it external sounds, let me back up. What I was hearing earlier, like as you were first talking, you were talking about, you know, starting with plot and then having to learn to explore character, you know, explore that internal piece. And I think a lot of us, when we're first starting writing, struggle with that. You know, I have a plot, I have a character, how do they work together? And mostly we're moving them around the board. But saying keeping it external, so you're saying now keep that plot external.
Well,
but really it's that internal it's that internal grind against the external that I think is what we're really reading for, right?
I think there's, well, there are two parts of it. And I guess I should expand upon that more. I personally, and it seems like at least some people do, you know, the folks who read me, I really like stories where there's a core group of people who have each other's back. And I don't like that there's a lot of conflict between them. Like when you read, when you watch movies or watch, especially happens on TV shows, okay, where they constantly, like they build up a bond between these people and then they shatter, and then they build up a bond between these people and they shatter. And that's like the main thrust. Like Supernatural skates around the edge of this a lot, the TV show, where the two brothers have this bond and then they do something, they screw up the bond. Now they've gotten better at that, but that sort of thing is really frustrating, I think, to a reader, because you want the characters to progress and to grow together. But you still do need to have internal conflict issues, and you can do that with romance, you can do that with illnesses, you can do that with a lot of different things. But when it comes down to the sort of stories that I prefer to read and I prefer to write, I'm writing Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. And there's not a lot of internal conflict in Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. It is almost mostly external conflict, but it is very character-driven. You know, the things that Indy fears, the passions that he has, you know, the fact that he hates Nazis, you know, stuff like that. It is all based very much around his character and what his beliefs are, but all the conflict itself is external.
Cool. So I guess one of the questions I like to ask are writer obsessions, and you're kind of illuminating that right now with having that bond of folks, those deeply bonded groups. Are there any other obsessions that you kind of have in your writing, or you know, themes or things you focus on?
I learned very recently that I'm not interested in writing stories without romance, which was sort of eye-opening for me. There's always a romantic element in all of my stories. I blame Anne McCaffrey for this. I think Anne McCaffrey tricked half of the male population who read science fiction into reading romances. We didn't know what she was doing to us, but most of her books are really actually romances, which I love. Like her Killashandra series is one of my favorite, the Crystal Singer books, some of my favorite books of all time, and they're straight up romances. And same with the Rowan books. The Rowan is a romance. So maybe she got into me or something like that, but I wrote a book, a series recently, where the romantic, the person that the main character is involved with romantically dies halfway through the series. And because of the character growth, I know that's a bad thing to do too. And I guess some people are rather upset at me for doing that, but
rather upset.
Yeah, it's where the story had to go. But what I found as well is that I actually was less interested in the story without there being a romance. And I thought about introducing a new romance, but it would have been crass. So I had to go on without, and I was able to sort of create some other elements that substituted for that. But, I was surprised to find that about myself, that I really want to have books that have romance in them. I think it makes sense because it's a big part of being human. So you can't really tell a human story without some of those elements in there as well. And I think the other big thing I have, this may be more of a pet peeve than something I'm fanatical about, is the time it takes to travel places drives me bonkers in books when they do it wrong. And this used to hit the most in fantasy, because I grew up reading far more fantasy than science fiction. If you got these characters and it takes them 4 days to go from point A to point B, they shouldn't be able to go from B to A in one day on the way back. And for me, that would destroy stories. One of the most frustrating ones is in Terry Brooks's Shannara books, where at one point, like usually it took them, whenever they traveled this particular part in the map, it took them a week. But one day, Al-Anon managed to do it in an evening. And I'm just like, what? Like, come on, you can't do that.
He's a druid. They can.
The core problem with those books is that he pronounces it Shannara, which is just all kinds of wrong. So
what? He does?
Yeah. He does. Yeah. Oh, just ruined God. It for me. Just
oh, well, you know, so. The funny thing is I learned not too long ago that Aeon is actually pronounced Eon. So
yeah. I was glad you're saying that, because I was like, oh, I always thought this was pronounced Eon.
just tell people it's the French pronunciation, you'll be fine.
There you go. Right. Yes, exactly.
The Canadian. I'm using that.
Yeah, for the French Canadian version. Aeon.
I told Michael I wouldn't make too many Canadian jokes.
That's right.
And he told me you can't make fun of Canadians. So
Canadians love to be made fun of. Canadians are like, yep, that's true. We're a bunch of goofballs in that particular area. We love it. It's for whatever reason, Canadians are not afraid to have a mirror held up. Which is nice.
In a kind way, though.
Right. So,
well, which I gotta admit, the one people that the Canadians don't typically like having mirrors held up is from Americans.
Yeah.
But everybody else can do it. Sorry.
Hey folks, Darilyn here. We decided to break this podcast into two episodes because we had so much fun talking to Michael Cooper that it ended up being an hour and a half long. So we'll cut off here and we'll see you in Episode B of the Michael Cooper interview, which will focus a little bit more on writing life and the business of being an author. See you soon. Thanks, everyone.